Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2010. Lecture 22, delivered on November 17, 2010. The title of this lecture is Agency.
Today, agency. To begin this lecture, I will have to give you a few definitions up front, and then I will be giving you more definitions along the way. Now, there will be definitions in here that might deviate somewhat from what you have will be told or taught in other courses. For example, I'm going to cover in a very summary manner contract. And the way I teach contract might not be the way you would learn it in someone else's business law course, but it's consistent with what I want you to know for this topic. Let me begin. A person, in legal terms, is an individual or a group that is definable within the framework of a contract. An individual or group that is definable within a contract. So a person could be you, a person could be a corporation, a partnership. A person under the law is not just an individual. There has been a significant challenge to this from liberals in recent months because the Supreme Court ruled in Citizens United that corporations had a personhood that extended to rights of free speech. Now, in fact, the Supreme Court had been ruling over the past 30, 40 years expanding the rights of corporations as far as constitutional matters are concerned, on especially speech rights. But it's somewhat upsetting to a number of people to imagine that under law a corporation could be a person. It is. And it has recognized rights. But it also has recognized duties too. And we'll get into that. So when I say a person here, I'm not necessarily referring to a person in your common vernacular. Now, in that definition I just gave you, I mentioned contract. A contract is an agreement that meets specific criteria. A contract is an agreement that meets specific criteria. First of all, in terms of a contract, and I will give you a four-pillar approach. Now, in other classes, you might hear three, six, even more than 10, depending upon what law book, law teacher you're hearing. But I use a four-pillar approach, which I learned from one of the great law professors long ago. The first provision that must exist in an agreement for it to rise to the level of a contract is offer and acceptance. Offer and acceptance. The offer must be specific. The offer must be timely. And the offer must be serious. Specific, timely, and serious. The acceptance must mirror the offer. That's called the mirror image rule. The acceptance must mirror the offer. I offer you my car for $600. You say, I accept, but the price shall be $500. That is not an acceptance under the legal definition of a contract. You made a counteroffer. A counteroffer kills an offer. A counteroffer kills an offer. As soon as you have countered, that my offer is gone. And I say, I reject. And you say, okay, I accept your $600 offer. And I say, I'm sorry, no. That offer has now been killed by your counteroffer. So I must make an offer again. Okay? A counteroffer kills an offer. The acceptance, if it is truly an acceptance of an offer, then it must mirror the offer, materially and pretty much in all respects. Now, the next part of the next pillar of a true contract would be mutual consideration. Thing of value for thing of value. Thing of value for thing of value. Let me see. Who should you, sir? You take a very attractive woman on a date. You take her bowling, and then you take her to Denny's. And then at the end of the evening, you are expecting to get a nice hug, and she says, "No." And you say, "Woman." You're working your way down the spiral here. You owe me. In fact, no, she doesn't. Because there was no agreement on mutual consideration. You gave her a thing of value, your love, your bowling skills, and your personal knowledge of the menu at Denny's. But that doesn't mean she has to give anything in return. So you go home. And you just spend the rest of the night prowling the internet for porn. Where the hell was I? A gift is not part. If I accept a gift, it's not a contract. I don't owe anything for taking a gift. Now, as far as mutual consideration goes, generally speaking, the things of value must be exchanged immediately. There is promissory estoppel, which means that there can be conditions under which one party renders its consideration at length. But generally, you have to provide the considerations are mutual in a timely manner. And the exception would be promissory estoppel. Now, mutual consideration can get into some severely complicated discussions. But let me break off here on contract. You can look at contracts in a number of different ways, break contracts down in different ways. On one set of dimensions, I could talk about express versus implied. Most of the contracts that you will enter in your life are implied, not expressed. It just happens. The contract forms as traditional, as a tradition, but that's it. There's not an expression. Now, there is also, I can break them down into written versus oral. Most of the contracts in which you will engage in your life are oral, not written. There is no defect in an oral contract. It is every bit as good as a written contract. Now, if there is a written contract, what is in the written language is all that there is of the contract. This is called the parole evidence rule. The parole evidence rule. That everything that is in the contract, and only what is in the written contract, if it is a written contract, is the contract. Well, we had this agreement. We talked about this. Well, where is it in the contract? Well, we didn't put that in the contract. Well, and it is not part of the contract. If it's a written contract. This is sometimes referred to as the Four Corners Doctrine. The Four Corners Doctrine. Oral contracts are perfectly fine. In fact, as I said, most of the contracts into which you will enter are oral contracts. When you go to McDonald's and you say, I should like a McBurger and a McDrink, and I am the McBurger boy, and I say McOkay, then that is an oral contract, but it's a perfectly valid contract. Perfectly valid. It will be executed in a timely manner, and it will be closed off very quickly. Now, in regards to that contract, as it forms, who is the offeror and who is the offeree in that contract right there?
I'm the offeree.
In fact, it's exactly the opposite. You are the offeror. I didn't make an offer. You made an offer. I solicited an offer, but what I did does not rise to the level of an offer. You know why? It's not specific enough. When you come in there, you see a board with food of different kinds. I'm not being specific. There's no offer. You make the offer, and by me taking the order and ringing up the charge and saying that will be, that's my acceptance. You see, that's one of the interesting things. For the most part, an advertisement is not considered an offer because it does not rise to the necessary level of specificity. Kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? That's why, you see, because most ads just don't have, well, you will buy three of these at this price at this time. It's not there, the specificity. So it is a solicitation for an offer, an advertisement is, a menu board, a menu in front of you, but it is not, in and of itself, an offer. The last way that I'll break up contracts is into bilateral versus unilateral. Let me give you an example. I shall wash your dog, and you shall clean my house. Okay? Now I come to you. I'll wash your dog if you'll clean my house. Those are two different contracts. What's the difference? Do you see the difference? I shall wash your dog and you shall clean my house. I shall wash your dog if you will clean my house. You see, under this contract with you, the second one, you have no obligation under the contract unless I perform. Under our contract, you have obligation whether or not I perform. Ours is bilateral. Ours, the second one, is unilateral. Do you understand the difference? It's kind of nuanced, and these are things that the common person would never know about. But when you begin to think about contract in these ways, you begin to realize that the whole world is a system of contracts and quasi-contracts. Now, the term quasi-contract means legally that it almost meets the criteria of a contract, but not quite. There's some defect. Now, courts will recognize quasi-contract, but they generally tend to be shy on working around, playing with quasi-contract. Now, the next of the four pillars, after mutual consideration, is legality. That date didn't work out the way you wanted. And so you're driving home, and you go down Market Street, and you stop at a light, and a very nice young lady says, "Hello, sailor." Now, you... whatever. There's obviously an offer and an acceptance. There's mutual consideration. But it's not a contract because it's not legal, you see. It's an agreement, but it's not a contract. You see, so you have to be, it has to be legal. Now understand that I'm going to take you a little bit, well, no, I'll wait until the next one. So contract forms, but it is not an actual contract unless it is a legal thing that is being negotiated. Goods or services, either one. It's not a contract if it's not legal. The last one is capacity. Capacity. Are the parties capable of entering into this contract? Are the parties capable of entering into this contract? Now, let me give you a couple of different angles on this. When you enter into a contract with a minor, and here I will put in parentheses, you are stupid as hell if you do, and end the parentheses. When you enter into a contract with a minor, the contract is voidable at the discretion of the minor, unless it is for a necessity. It is voidable. That doesn't mean it's void, but it's voidable at the discretion of the minor. So if you enter into a contract with a minor, and it's not for something like desperation, food, shelter, that kind of thing, then the minor can say, "I hereby void this contract," and it's over. Even if that a minor has taken a thing of value from you before you got a thing of value from the minor. That's why it is risky to enter into contracts with minors, unless there is statutory provision exempting the capacity. Now, capacity has other aspects too. Historically, capacity has been used to discriminate. For example, many states since time immemorial said that two people with Down syndrome could not get married, because they didn't have the capacity to understand the relationship. Fortunately, time has allowed for some better understanding of mental retardations and understanding that there is quite a bit that can be taught and learned, amazing amounts. There is a person with Down syndrome, I believe, recently who earned a PhD. This capacity has been used kind of like a weapon in some cases. It is still used on minors. A minor is not capable of consent, which is the basis for most anti-sex laws that involve minors. But capacity has another aspect to it, too. Let me give you an example. And I am going to deviate from what is said in some law books. And I will defend what I'm going to say I can reference other law books that say exactly what I am saying here. And so don't play the game, because you'll find out in the end that I am probably right with my law experts. Here's the story. Two couples down in Georgia, they would meet every Friday night, alternately at one couple's house and then at the other couple's house. And they would spend Friday night getting drunk, playing games, and just generally having a good time. Well, one night at the one couple's house, they were all sitting around, they were all smashed, laughing, and the guy who owned the house said, "This house is just such a piece of crap, I'd sell it for a dollar." And the other couple was laughing, "No, you wouldn't." He said, "Yes, I would." And so the guy said, "Okay, I'll buy it for a dollar. Write it, sign the house over to me." So the drunk guy signed a napkin of some kind. "I hereby sell this house to you for a dollar." And so the next day the guy came over with his dollar. No, that was a joke. I've got a napkin that says you were selling it to me for a dollar. You signed it. Actually, that was a contract. It was a written contract. It was specific. It was serious. And it was valid. And now the couple that were going to lose their house for a dollar just absolutely said, no, capacity wasn't there. We were drunk. That generally is not in and of itself enough to demonstrate a lack of capacity and therefore a lack of formation of a contract. You can't just say, I was drunk, I was stoned, I was blottoed, I was shit-faced, or whatever it would be. I wouldn't say that to a court, really. But here's the thing. Don't bet on it. Go.
Isn't there some law that says, though, that it has to be some, like, balance and, like, what they exchange?
Yeah, but it was freely entered into. These couples agreed to a dollar. There is no reason a government would step in a fairness kind of way for a contract. The government generally considers some contracts contrary to public policy. That is law. But in terms of what constitutes fairness, you're going to have a hard time finding many laws, state level certainly, that would govern, that would allow judges to see fairness, balance in a contract. That would be unlikely. And that's an interesting point there, too, because when you get to things like gay rights, the right of gays to marry, that's a contract. Now, generally speaking, the government wants to claim, well, we don't get involved in contracts other than what is contrary to public policy. In other words, you have to reach a high hurdle for the government to say no contract can be formed on this basis. So, generally speaking, it has to be a really high level before the government would step in and say, no, this is, before a court, I should say, would step in and cite statutory law and say, no, this isn't fair. Unless there was some major public policy issue involved. And that goes to the old saying, what the defense lawyer, the first thing he'll do is pound his fist on the evidence. If that doesn't work, you pound your fist on the law books. And if that doesn't work, you pound your fist on public policy. And there are not a lot of courts that are going to let him get to the point where he's pounding his fist on public policy for the fairness of a transaction. If you are stoned, if you are drunk, don't assume that that is enough to claim that a contract was not formed and that you want to have a court void the contract or to declare that the contract didn't exist in the first place. Now, these four are the foundations for contract, and it's really summary. You take a course from me in business law, and I'll tell you all kinds of stories about every one of those case law. But for our purposes today, this is enough. Now I'm going to get to the meat of this lecture, which has to do with agency. Now, recall that I distinguished among agent, broker, and dealer earlier in this course. Here, I am approaching the concept of agency from a different perspective. And for the purposes of this lecture and this theoretical globe of understanding, an agent is a person charged with maximizing the welfare of another. An agent is a person charged with maximizing the welfare of another. An agent is a person charged with maximizing the welfare of another. Presumably, under contract. Presumably under contract. Now remember that could be expressed or implied, written or oral. That's the agent. The principal is the person whose interest, welfare, I should say, the person whose welfare is to be maximized by the agent. The principal is the person whose welfare is to be maximized by the agent. The principal is a person whose welfare is to be maximized by the agent. So, the board of directors of a company are the agents of the shareholders. The board of directors of a company are the agents, are individually in their capacities and as a body, the agent of the shareholders. The shareholders are the principal. It is the duty of the board of directors and the management to maximize the welfare of the shareholders. That's not the stakeholders. You will never hear me talk about the stakeholders in that regard. The duty of the board and of the management is to maximize the welfare of the shareholders. So the board is, as a body, and in individuals, in their capacity, they are agents of the principal, which is the shareholders. Let me give you some other ones here, too. Clearly, a soldier is the agent of the Constitution. He swears an oath to the Constitution, not to the president, not to the flag, not to his drill sergeant, not to the people waving their stupid-ass little flags for him as he marches by in the parade. He or she is an agent of the Constitution. That is who, that is the party, that is the person that we vow to defend. So there you are. Constitution would be a person. Now let me try some other ones. A child and a parent. A child and a parent. In that relationship, let me try. Find someone who would. Who is the agent and who is the principal in a parent-child relationship? Who does it seem?
The child. No.
You're reading back through the notes. Good. Anyone want to take a stab? Who's the agent? Who's the principal? Say it.
The child.
Child's what? The child is the? Bingo! Yes, the child is the principal. The parent is the one charged with maximizing the welfare of the child. So that definitionally means that the parent is the actual agent. The child is the principal in that relationship. Isn't that interesting? Let's try marriage. Marriage is a contract. Who's the agent and who is the principal? Madam, don't go there. No, who's the agent and who's the principal? Off the top of your head.
Man's agent.
Is that so? No, in fact, the man and the woman are both the agents. The marriage is the principal. The marriage is a person. The marriage is a person under the law. I can assure you of that. And both of you, the man and the woman, the husband and wife, are charged with maximizing the welfare of the principal, the welfare of the marriage. You getting the idea of agent and principal now? It doesn't. You kind of want to think about humans in this. Not always. Not necessarily. People may be behind it, but that there can be quite valid principals who are not flesh and blood in and of themselves. They can be persons. That was why I brought up that person's definition at the beginning of this lecture. was to give you the to try to lay the groundwork for what I'm doing now. Okay, now, let's move to the next step. We have agent is a person charged, usually by a under contract, with maximizing the welfare of another, who is called the principal. But here's the defect. It's called the agency dilemma. Sometimes, in some courses, I would certainly not do that in a dignified setting like this, but I would say this is what's called the people suck rule. You see, an agent has an incentive to maximize his own welfare instead of that of the principal. Every agent has an incentive to maximize his own welfare instead of the principal's. Again, every agent has an incentive to maximize his own welfare instead of that of the principal. Every agent does. No matter how good you are, no matter what a fine, upstanding stud or young woman you are, you have an incentive to maximize your own welfare instead of that of the principal. That is just that's just reality. You will do so as the agent to the extent that you can. And I'll write this down. Every agent has incentive to maximize his own welfare. Instead of that of the principal. And we'll do so to the extent that he can. He will do so to the extent that he can based upon the monitoring and the enforcement covenants of his contract with the principal. And he will, to the extent that he can, based upon the monitoring and enforcement covenants of his contract with the principal. Monitoring and enforcement. Both of those have to be in the contract. Both of those have to be in the contract. Now, if you are the principal, it is your duty first to ensure that monitoring and enforcement provisions are there. And second, that they are both effective. The covenants of monitoring and the covenants of enforcement. Both of those have to be there. And that is the principal's job to see that that is in the contract. And it is the principal's duty to ensure that those monitoring and enforcement provisions are effective. You see, if you work for a company, I can assume that you're an agent, you are going to maximize the welfare of the owners. But I also assume that you have an incentive to maximize your own welfare instead. Unless we have an understanding that is complete and thorough and legal about monitoring you and enforcing the provisions, then I, as the principal, as the owner, have failed. Because I have to assume the agency dilemma is in play. You are a rational person. You will maximize your own welfare. Now, you say, well, no, I wouldn't. I wouldn't steal. I cannot assume your intentions. I can assume only your capabilities. And this is where the hard world of business begins to bite you in the butt. And it's my job to tell you this, that you have to assume as bosses, and you will be, some of you will be captains, some of you will be lieutenants, but you'll all be leaders out there someday, that the people under you, you can't assume their intentions. You have to assume their capabilities. As the late President Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify. Let me tell you a story. I have seen some of you driving down the road. You drive like blind trout. Now, I'm driving along here, and you're driving along on one of these nice straight country roads. It's a beautiful day, sunny, just a straight arrow road. And you are past this sign that says 55 miles per hour. Well, I better go 55 miles an hour. Yep, 10-4. Bullshit. You know what you're going to say? Warp 6, Mr. Sulu. You're going to push down on that pedal. Because you are not being monitored and enforced. What is your incentive other than if you have some ugly car that parts will fly off, or if you're afraid of seeing the stars streaming by you? But other than that, you're going to break the speed limit. I have to assume that. Now, let's say that up ahead, you're driving along. You have finally begin to, you're getting into some real, you're getting into a groove around a good speed. And up way up the road, you see a car parked off the road in a spur into a field. As you get closer, you recognize, oh my God, that's cop markings on that car, police markings. Now, what are you going to do then? Yeah, you are going to honk that brake. Monitoring. That's what slowed you down. Don't tell me you haven't seen all the cars cruising by you and all of a sudden brake lights all up the road. Well, you can assume that's a cop up the road there. Okay, now you're slowed down. As you get closer, you suddenly realize the guy, the policeman is standing out beside his car. Wait a minute. He's changing the tire on his car. So what are you going to do?
Go.
Yeah. And wave at him. The one with the, you use only one finger for it. Enforcement wasn't there. You see, it's not enough to monitor. There has to be the enforcement value too. The prospect that there will be an enforcement. Now here's the deal though. Here's the deal. There is only so far you will go under contract. There's only so far before the cost of one more round of monitoring enforcement becomes more than what you get from your agent in compliance. I'll tell you, there was a story, a famous story of my own, a meatpacking plant. They had been having a problem with theft by employees, meat being taken out. It was a small operation, but it was serious enough. They had, and they knew it was happening. Employees were taking food out of meat. There were jokes about how women would come in not pregnant, and then they'd go out pregnant, probably about to give birth to a roast that they were hiding under their coat going out. And so they worked out the details, and I helped them to get cameras in place and all that. It turned out that once they found out how much the camera systems would cost, how much it would cost to watch those cameras, well, how much training they'd have to get to learn how to detain people without getting sued, it was cheaper for them to let people take a few things. It really was. Now, the agent will take his maximization of his own welfare in terms of four costs. And we call those the agency costs. The agency costs. Cost one is shirking. Shirking. avoiding your duties as an agent. Avoiding your duties as an agent. Avoiding your duties as an agent. I love the story about the one upper level manager. He was so proud of himself. I go home every night and my desk is clear. It's never cluttered. Well, that's because the son of a bitch gives everyone else his work. All of his subordinates. That's shirking. Hanging around the water cooler. Walking around chatting with other people in the office. Shirking. Avoiding your duties. The next agency cost is perquisites. Perquisites. Taking benefits as a result of your position. Taking inappropriate benefits as a result of your position. Sometimes we call them perks. Well, that's one of the perks. An example in this regard. This is a few years old. I was with some managers at a company, and they were talking about how some of the people at their company, when they go out of town on trips, they first of all get first-class tickets. This is the upper management. And they stay at five-star hotels, go to the best restaurants in the city, and all of those great things. And I just was so annoyed by it. I said, you know, you need me to be your comptroller. Greyhound goes to most cities. Denny's has a damn good meal. And you know what? I know hotels in almost every city that are real cheap. And just for a quarter, you can make the bed vibrate. And they were, they weren't going to have any of that. Well, this is part of, this is something we have to do to show off. No, you're taking money from the shareholders. That differential between that fancy airplane and a bus or a cheapo ticket on an airplane, if that's what you want to do, if you want to go through the porno scanners they got now. Whatever. You know what? That's shareholder money. That's principal money you're taking that you don't need to take. You go into an executive's offices, the desk is as big as some aircraft carrier landing decks. That's a perk. That's basically how it works. But it doesn't mean that it's not an agency cost. An extraction, a maximization of the welfare of the individual instead of the welfare of the principal. Now, here's another one. Direct theft. Direct theft. That's an agency cost. Just stealing from the company. I saw a wonderful example of that some years back. Back, I think probably before your time, maybe it was still when you were alive, there was this big fascination with frozen yogurt. And there were these chains of frozen yogurt places that were coming up. Do any of you remember frozen yogurt? How Frogurt? I was sitting in this one place, and I was just grazing on my yogurt, and this whole group of people, just lots of people, just came in after I did. And I was just sitting there watching the line. It was just getting long. These yuppies were standing there. It was in Yuppieville, and their kids were bouncing around and hopping up and down. And I noticed that the line was just getting longer and longer. There was one girl handling the cash register, and she was going surprisingly slowly compared to the people who were preparing the ice cream. The three people who were preparing the orders. And what she was doing, it was kind of interesting because when someone would give, she'd say, that's $12.15. They'd give her a 20 and she'd just very slowly work out the change. But sometimes the bill would come up to a nice round number. Or someone would be in line long enough to work out what the price was going to be and give her the right amount. In those cases, she would just take the money, put it on the counter, and say, next, put it in front of her. And, of course, the people who had paid her were just thrilled to get out of there. The next people rushed up while finally the line's moving. And every once in a while, she just kind of leaned into the cash register. And when she leaned back, that money wasn't there. She was extracting an agency cost. And she was quite good at it, too. But direct theft is all over the place. The question is monitoring and enforcement going to get you more compliance than it's going to cost you to do it? Now, here's the last one. Incompetence. Incompetence is an agency cost. Incompetence is an agency cost. There is a famous rule, and when back in the day when Professor Peter, who developed this principle, laid it out, people who were not in the business world thought it was like some kind of a funny ha-ha kind of joke. It is not a joke at all. The Peter principle states that everyone in a corporation will rise to his or her level of incompetence. Every person in a corporation will rise to his or her level of incompetence. And I will explain exactly how logical that rule is. You, woman, you get in on the ground floor of the corporation, you do incredibly well in your position. So you're obviously going to be promoted. Meritocracy and all that, they'll promote you. And you just do a bang-up job in that position. So they raise your position again. You do excellently, so you get noticed, you rise in the corporation. Eventually, you rise to a job where you can't do it. You're incompetent. That's where you'll stay. You look at any organization, every person is on his way to or has arrived at his or her level of incompetence. That's how it works. Think about that when you're thinking about CEOs. Think about that when you're thinking about coaches. Think about that at every level of management. People are on their way up, and they will stop when they have hit their level of incompetence. They won't rise anymore. Some people will just rise and rise because they're competent, but they will stop when they're no longer competent. Donald Trump comes to mind. He rose to Mount Olympus. Incompetence is all over the place. Assume that your boss is on his way to incompetence or has arrived there. Sounds a little odd, doesn't it? But it's a cruel thing. But incompetence is probably the worst of the agency costs. In government, it is a terrible problem. And that doesn't mean with the bureaucrats. It means with politicians. It means with the powerful people. The men like the Ben Bernankes. The men who are and women who are at the helm of the head of state, in the White House and in Congress, and in the courts too. Think about the Supreme Court in that regard. Now, those are the agency costs. Now, this is agency, and this is agency duty. You are, as an agent, duty bound by contract, usually, to maximize the welfare of the principal. You will do so to the extent that you can't extract agency costs. And that will be the responsibility of the principal. It is the principal's duty to monitor and enforce. But you see, as the agents, we will extract our costs whenever we can. And that is pervasive in your organizational life. You'll cut slack for yourself. You'll pinch a couple of paper clips or something like that. You'll avoid your duties. Some days you'll come into work and you'll be brain dead, incompetent. Most of you won't be into direct theft. But agency costs and the agency dilemma is all over the place. Take a parent-child relationship. And I'm speaking here as a parent. I am the agent of the child. I am charged with maximizing the welfare of the child. Imagine what it's like to come home at the end of a long day. You're tired. You're supposed to prepare that child a nutritious meal. Instead, I'll prepare that child nuke and puke. I will. And if I've got the wherewithal to drive to the fast food place, I'll buy Snarf and Barf. And those kids, there they are. You go in, I'm dog tired, I collapse on the chair, and the kids are bouncing up and down, swinging from the lanterns, and they're bouncing up and down on the couch. Now, my duty is to rush over and grab that child. Come on, let's get down from there. You're going to hurt yourself. Come on, let's go do something that's educational. We'll have some fun together. No, that's not what I'm going to do. I'm just going to sit there in the chair. You, get off that couch, goddammit. Here, take my belt. Beat yourself on the ass. Go stand in the corner. I do not lie. And you will know what I'm talking about someday. Believe me. But you see, that's a key on one problem. Not all agency relationships are the same. There is a kind of agency relationship where the principal cannot perform his duty. Remember, the duty of the principal is the monitoring and enforcement. That's the principal's job. The agent is going to screw up. The agent is going to extract agency costs. You got to assume that. It is the principal's job to keep that from happening. But there are some principles that by the nature of the relationship, by the nature of the principal himself or herself, cannot do it. A doctor is the agent of the patient. So in that regard, the patient is the principal, so it's the patient's job to monitor and enforce the performance of the doctor, right? But how many of you are well-trained enough in medical science to know what's right and what's wrong? Specifically, if you are in surgery and you are under anesthetic, you have no way to monitor and enforce. Say why? Well, yeah, but think about it. I mean, you know, I wonder when I'm under anesthetic how many times the word oops happens. You know, if I'm awake, oops, wait, oops, what? No, mofo, you stop. What? Oops. Think about lawyers. The lawyer is the agent of the principal, you. But the lawyer is also the agent of the law, too. That's a problem, and I'll get to that in a little bit here. But you don't have enough knowledge of the law to monitor and enforce. You can actively participate in your defense, but you do not have the knowledge necessary to do all that would be all that you should as a true principal. So the child, even though the child's the principal, the child doesn't know right from wrong. Believe me, I can talk kids with candy and enough threats. I can talk the child into believing that Nukin Puke is good for him. Well, those parents who make their own food, they just don't love you enough. You know, you can do that. You see, so a child doesn't have that level of capacity under contract. Oh, so this actually goes back to contract. There are agency relationships where capacity is weak on the part of the principal. We have a name for relationships like this, where the principal has a capacity defect that is of the nature. We call these fiduciary relationships. Fiduciary relationships. And if it is a fiduciary relationship, the agency's duties are no longer normal agency duties. The agency's duties are fiduciary duties. In a marriage, the contract, the marriage is the principal. The marriage can't monitor and enforce. It's a contract. It's a non-human thing. It cannot. Therefore, the relationship is fiduciary. And the agents, the husband and the wife, are then charged with special duty, fiduciary duty. A soldier has fiduciary duty to the Constitution. The Constitution can't protect itself. It can't monitor and enforce. That means that my duty as a soldier becomes a fiduciary duty because there's a capacity defect in my principle, my Constitution. And I understand that. Fiduciary duty, according to Black's Law Dictionary, is the highest duty implied by law. Fiduciary duty is the highest duty implied by law. Fiduciary duty has three aspects: trust, loyalty, and fidelity. In other words, faithfulness. As an agent in a fiduciary relationship, the principal cannot monitor you sufficiently. The principal cannot enforce the covenant sufficiently. And it becomes incumbent upon you in these relationships and these relationships only to bear the weight yourself via trust, loyalty, and faithfulness. It is a very special kind of relationship. It is a relationship you have to your shareholders as an agent of the shareholders. It is a duty that you have as a partner in a marriage. It is a duty you have as a civil servant or a soldier to your Constitution. It is a duty you have as a doctor to your patient or a lawyer to your client. These fiduciary relationships are special. Don't let people blow smoke up your ass. I've seen companies that said, well, you employees that work on the line, you have a fiduciary duty to do your best. Bullshit. They're watering down what fiduciary duty means. The fiduciary duty is important. And congressmen and at the state and especially the federal level are passing laws, you know, saying, well, this is a fiduciary duty, and therefore we'll punish you if you don't. That's irrelevant in a sense. A fiduciary duty, you have to understand it inside of you. It's more than just your regular job, your regular duty. Now, here's one last thing about fiduciary duty for you. Be careful about taking on fiduciary duty. You can't just pretend that it's not fiduciary duty. It is whether you want it to be or not. And when you have a fiduciary duty, it takes precedence over all other duties. That means that if you go and take more than one fiduciary duty, you've got yourself a handful. Speaking as I told you, I'm a parent. And I was also the agent of a corporation, and I was very, very high up, and that meant that I had two fiduciary duties. I had two highest duties, and I did not perform one of those duties to the best of my ability because I can't perform two highest duties. And what that meant was that one night I went home, and I had an empty house. It seems a fiduciary duty will punish you if you don't take it seriously. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.